There's now time for question and answer, so if you have a question, I invite you to make your way to the microphone. I do have to say personally, I'm a new dad. I mean, I'm a 3.5-month-old, so this is encouraging and challenging.
Okay.
And I encourage, if I say I'll encourage my wife to watch this, you might interpret that. I mean, I can't know first, it's
on my book. Okay. Great,
I think one of the challenges, we had a bill before the Canadian Parliament recently to enshrine gender expression and gender identity in Canadian law. And quite difficult to speak against that, and very complicated to speak against that. And I think it's often dominated by the stories of those who feel discriminated against versus the data.
Right.
How could you encourage us to continue to discuss this, especially with those who would consider gender irrelevant?
Well, I think one thing it's important to do is to recognize that there are going to be men and women who don't kind of conform to these average patterns. And I think sometimes their experience becomes, you know, really magnified in public discourse. The people who kind of are on, you know, some end of the curve, if you will, you know, the bell curve. So to recognize that there is going to be diversity, that not all women experience motherhood in the same way, that not all men experience fatherhood in the same way, and so that we have to be, you know, cognizant of that reality and have some kind of way of accommodating it. But at the same time, to sort of recognize that, you know, on average, these are some sort of patterns that are pretty clear, not only for human beings, but for primates, for heaven's sakes. And if, you know, people want to be kind of, if they want to kind of bury their head in the sand and practice a kind of feminist fundamentalism, well, they can do that, but that's anti-science. I think you have to sort of make the point that the science here is on our side, you know, and that we can look both at this species and other species to see some of these fundamental patterns at work, and that those who disagree with us on this, you know, really need to sort of get with the science. Would be my, I mean, that's a sort of strong way of putting it, but I think it's true too. So.
Well, you pretty well asked the question, so I'll rephrase it a bit to get from a different slant a bit. Certainly, you speak of the aspects of basically the abilities of women in terms of, shall we say, the tender years.
Right.
That's often used again in courts and other institutions saying, well, therefore, that's the best parent. Of course, you can't, but then you also show that, you know, lots of other benefits of both parents come into play, maybe a little bit later. But of course, courts are like forever, right? How do you approach the argument? Say, you know, other than saying, well, you know, if you think the kid will be better off with two parents by the time they're four, you kind of want to start the process now, right? You can't say, well, you know, single parent for 3 years and then we'll let the other one come back in. I mean, how do you deal with that? Basically, I said the 10 years doctrine is kind of a vestige of earlier times, and it's still here.
So you're saying, how do I deal with the 10 years doctrine?
Well, the idea that, you know, mothers, because they can breastfeed, are the better parent. Therefore, you know, simplify the thing, have the child there, and then we'll work out the rest of it later. But that's, I think, from what you've shown, is somewhat of a specious argument. So, any ideas as to how you deal with that oversimplification of the process?
Well, I think, you know, the key here is to sort of try to get people to understand that even though moms may have an advantage when it comes to those years when kids are infants and toddlers, I think particularly as kids get older and older, the distinctive gifts that dads on average bring to the parenting enterprise really enter into the picture. And that, you know, we need to attend to those gifts, we need to recognize the way in which dads really do play a central role in the formation of their children. And that unfortunately, because of the breakdown of marriage in Canada, the United States, and many other developed countries, we're splitting apart, you know, these two parents, and we're forcing the state to pick one parent oftentimes as the primary caretaker. And, you know, in many contexts, it's going to be the mother. And I think, you know, there's obviously a great tragedy there, because those kids are losing day-to-day contact oftentimes with their father. And their father, you know, as I've said, you know, today, in a number of ways, brings some distinctive gifts. The other point to make is that, and I mentioned that, you know, generally speaking, women are stronger in kind of the day-to-day nurturing, and the dads are a bit more distant from the parenting enterprise. And this kind of view, which I think is held by many academics, has been advanced in some context to suggest that two moms would actually be even better than a mother and a father. But I think what that doesn't recognize is that kids also need to have a caregiver in the home, in the family, who isn't kind of always hovering in a sense over them, and that kind of lets them go and you know, skin their knee, or lets them, you know, experience the feeling of being thrown up in the air as a toddler and then being caught, you know. So that there's something about having that, you know, that security that often comes from mom, and then having that challenge, that push out of the nest that often comes from dad, and that there's a kind of beauty and power to being exposed as a child to both of these two things. So we need to balance them. And we need to make sure that in discussions of divorce and child custody, that we are a lot more intentional about making sure that dads are connected to their kids than oftentimes we do, at least from what I've seen in the U.S. So,
thank you. Your study of the family that prays together got a lot of attention here in Canada. And I was wondering if you were relating the benefits to the chance of divorce. I was wondering if you had studied the effect on teens or children as well.
Okay, so I did a study in the fall of last year that looked at reports of marital happiness among African Americans, Latinos, and whites. And what we found there is we looked at the impact of attending church together, sharing the same religious values, and praying together as a couple. And we defined praying as things outside of just saying grace at meals. So it was actually, you know, kind of a deliberate effort for a husband and wife to pray together. And what we found in those three things was that they were all correlated to higher quality marriages, but that the most powerful predictor of those three, attendance, beliefs, and prayer together, was prayer together. That was the thing that was most strongly associated with couples being happier in their marriages. I've also found it in a different body of work that individuals in the U.S. who attended several times a month or more were 35% less likely to divorce compared to their peers who did not attend regularly. And I was just looking at individuals. If we were to look at spouses who attend together, I think the effect would have been even larger than that. Now, in terms of the outcomes on kids, I haven't done that particular research, but I have a colleague, John Barkowski, who's in Texas, UT San Antonio, who has looked at that issue. And he does find that kids do better both by their parents' ratings and also by their teachers' ratings when their parents attend religious services together. Whereas when they're not attending together, not the same benefit. So all this, I think, suggests on the religion front, to answer your question, is that having some unity between mom and dad, and that's not always, of course, possible. We all know that either from family or friends or our own experience. But when you can have that unity of life, religiously speaking, between a mother and a father, that seems to have a positive impact on the marriage and the parent-child relationship.
Thanks, Brad. That's very interesting and enjoyable to listen to. With your data that you've had, it sounds like you have a lot of international data going into that research at this time as well. Your thoughts on European, North American progressive countries, quote-unquote, versus countries that have had, at least in the mainstay, more of a traditional outlook on some of these issues that you're talking about.
Yeah.
How broad a difference are you seeing? What can you reflect in terms of the differences in what some of those outcomes are, positively negative, in both sets of countries?
That's a great question. I actually hope to answer that question, you know, with some more work, in part with IMSC on the we're hopefully doing a project next year on education. But I can talk a bit about sort of the input side of things. What we know is that even though, for instance, the TFR, the fertility rate, is close to replacement in the United States, for instance, and in Sweden, as we heard earlier today, marriage itself as an institution in some ways is weaker in those societies, including the U.S., compared to many Southern European countries and many East Asian countries that have a comparatively low fertility rate. So what's happened in those countries is they still want to connect, you know, marriage and parenthood. They have a fairly sort of stringent approach to doing that. And in part because of that, they're not having, you know, kids outside of wedlock and boosting their overall fertility rate. So what we're seeing around the world, I think, unfortunately, in much of the developed world, is that either fertility is going fairly well on the one hand, or marriage is going fairly well on the other hand. And what we're not seeing really in many countries in the developed world, be they in Asia or the Americas or Europe, is that any one country, you know, in those different regions is successfully combining replacement fertility with strong marriages. So, you know, either they're not having enough kids to sustain themselves over time, or they're not having kids in the kinds of contexts where they're going to be getting the attention and the affection that they need from both their mother and their father. So I think as we look at the outcomes for kids, we'll see how either being raised in kind of a low fertility regime or being raised in a regime where you're not as likely to be raised in a stable married household, how all those things affect kids. But that's really more to come. I guess I would just say one thing in terms of the outcomes. We do know from Sweden, there's a very good study done about 8 years ago that looked at the entire population of Swedish children, and they compared single parent families with two parent families. And of course, they actually didn't differentiate those who were cohabiting with those who were married, because they don't do that in Sweden oftentimes. They just sort of lump them all together. But nonetheless, they found that kids who were living in the single parent families were much more likely to have thoughts of suicide, to have difficulties with drugs and alcohol. And of course, this was striking because these sort of negative psychological findings were coming out in a society, as we heard just a little while ago, where there really is no child poverty. So you couldn't blame these outcomes on the fact that there were poor single mothers, you know, doing their work as moms. It was clearly related to the structure and the lack of dad in the household. So, okay. Yes, sir.
The California ruling you presented, you quoted, in which the judge basically says that gender is of no consequence in parental rearing. Was it challenged in any formal way, appealed or challenged? Was your work or your type of work presented, and what was the outcome of it?
It has been appealed, and the Ninth Circuit is now considering that appeal. It'll probably go on. I mean, because the Ninth Circuit is the most progressive circuit in the United States, that circuit will probably, I think, uphold either the whole ruling or aspects of the ruling, and that will then, I think, go to the Supreme Court. But there are a number of scholars who are working in a kind of try to improve the level of scholarly discourse on that question you just raised, and also to bring new evidence to bear on the Supreme Court decision, which will come probably at some point in 2012. So, yes.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
It's great to see you. I just want to ask with regards to the stats, I know it's not exactly part of your talk, but with regards to gender, what happens with two moms, two dads? So homosexual couples, do they follow the same pattern as the single parent because there's lacking the other, either feminine or masculine side?
Well, that's, I think, the $100,000 question moving forward. And Ross Park, who is a psychologist at the University of California, Riverside, has done a chapter for a book I'm doing on gender and parenthood that suggests that in many gay and lesbian households, they actually do have a kind of role of specialization, if you will, that's also kind of gendered in the sense that one partner tends to be more masculine and one partner tends to be more feminine, even though there's either two women or two men. And the question, you know, is how does that affect the kids? On the research more generally, of course, there was a lit review done for the Canadian case here a number of years ago by my colleague Stephen Nock at the University of Virginia. What I would say is that much of that literature, methodologically speaking, is quite limited, where they're dealing with samples. Actually, most of the studies that have been done, about 40 peer-reviewed studies, are based upon samples of less than 110 kids, and you know, probably less than 50 or 40 kids from same-sex households. It's also the case, too, that many of the comparison groups are not with the intact bio-married family. So you're comparing, say, kids from a lesbian household to kids in a blended family or kids in a single-parent family. And I'm not sure that tells you very much. So we're looking now to do some larger, random, representative studies where you're taking kids from a variety of family contexts, including same-sex households, and you know, doing a much more rigorous study from sort of a methodological perspective to see, you know, what that tells us. And so I think, you know, the point I would make here too is that it really took us about 25 years to figure out how the divorce revolution affected kids, and we got this sort of really good results in the 1990s. bearing in mind, of course, the Dwarfs Revolution hit in the 70s. So I think we have to wait, you know, as a scientist, I would have to wait probably about, you know, 15 more years to get a sense of how kids are raised in same-sex households, to not only as sort of, you know, 8-year-olds in school, but also, of course, as people who are forming their own families and whatnot. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Based on the information you've given us, I assume that you would be in favor of governments promoting and encouraging single-income families, where there's one income earner and preferably the mother caring for the children. Do you find any movement anywhere in the world trying to convince governments to go in that direction?
I don't find any movement, at least in the developed world, that I'm aware of on that front. But I guess I want to be careful here, too, because I think what I've also discovered in my work is that, at least in the United States, the modal preference for women who are married with children, not this is what their preference is, not what the practice is, but the modal preference for about 45% of married moms, this is moms with kids ages, you know, 6 months to 16 years, is to be working part-time. And about 35% would like to be at home full-time, and about, actually it's precisely 18% would like to work full-time. So I'm not necessarily opposed to dual earners. I think we have to just recognize, though, that in most families, the preference will be on the part of the mother is to be at home full-time or to have a kind of a foot in the workforce part-time. And that I think that kind of orientation would be probably, you know, more politically palatable too, but also it does sort of recognize, at least in our current milieu, that there are a lot of women out there who are moms who would like to work part-time, and for one reason or another they feel they can't really manage that. So.
Last question is to you.
Are there studies, or do you think there would be value in studying the role of others in raising children, the moms and dads? They might be uncles, they might be aunts, they might be grandparents. They might even be macro influencers in society, like athletes, political leaders, teachers. Are there studies being done about their impact upon families, or do you think there might be value in studying that?
I think it's a good question. Something we should be studying. There has been some work looking at single mothers who are relying upon their own mothers, their grandmothers, to help rear the kids, and that actually, this is once again my mentor at Princeton, Sarah McClanahan, that didn't work out so well. And I think probably it's a question of who's really the mom. Is it mom or grandma? And that can be problematic for some of these families. But I think one thing we also don't know, too, is that how does the intact nuclear family compare in its success raising kids compared to the intact extended family? Of course, there are many more immigrant families both in the U.S. and in Canada who have both mom and dad and grandma and grandpa, or, you know, some other kin, aunts and uncles, who are involved in the rearing of children. And that can be more complicated for, you know, mom and dad, the parents at times, for reasons that are obvious, I think, to anyone who has kin and whatnot. But from a kid's perspective, that might be the ideal. So I think it'd be interesting to look at maybe the best thing for a child, or from a child's perspective, is to have the active involvement not just of mom and dad, but of, you know, grandparents and uncles and aunts on a regular basis. So, but that's a good question. So.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And actually, we'll go away to Jet.
Okay.
On behalf of the IMFC and all this year.
Great. Thank you very much.